evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the stories we're covering for you today, Thursday, September 19th, 2019. President Kiir holds a prayer meeting at the Presidential Palace.
I want to frankly tell you that in November, it's a must that the government shall be formed. If the SPLM-IO does not want the formation of the government, the other parties that signed the peace agreement have to go ahead with the SPLM and form the...
And the UNMISS chief tells the UN Security Council there's progress in South Sudan, but there's still a long way to go.
The challenge remains, of course, is to show tangible results. And three areas in particular require progress. First, the unification of security forces.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. President Salva Kiir is calling on the country's armed forces to stop unnecessary shootings, which he calls all too common in South Sudan. Kiir made the remarks at a prayer service held at the Presidential Palace today. A church leader says aside from prayers, political leaders must restore peace in the country. Winnie Serino has more for VOA from Juba.
While welcoming participants of the prayer meeting at the Presidential Palace, locally known as Jowan, Mr. Kiir said he deliberately left the walls of the palace unrepaired so that the holes caused by gunfire during the July 2016 fighting between government troops and rebel leader Riek Machar's bodyguards remain visible. Kiir said the holes are a symbol of the untreated wounds of the South Sudanese people. About 1,000 people, including government officials, judges, civil society activists and religious leaders participated in the prayer service. Speaking in Arabic, Kiir said the communal prayer was for all South Sudanese. The president also said he is determined to fully implement the revitalized peace agreement and form a unity government by the November deadline.
I want to frankly tell you that in November, it's a must that the government shall be formed. If the SPLM-IO does not want the formation of the government, the other parties that signed the peace agreement have to go ahead with the SPLM and form the government. I hope my colleague here, Henry Odoa, will take my message to Dr. Riek Machar that we want all of us here in Juba. Even if he comes in October, we don't have a problem.
President Kiir used the event to call on the country's armed forces to stop unnecessary shootings and carrying out armed robberies on civilians.
I want to tell you that in recent days, the situation in Juba is reverting to a situation that we don't want. Because at night you sleep in your room, but you hear gunshots. What is there to be shot at night? There are some people who want to eat what is not theirs. And people who go and shoot at night are the soldiers. Even these people who are called the defense forces. These things must stop.
Kiir urged military, national security agents, and all other authorities to work together to ensure there is no more nighttime gunfire. Paulino Lokudu-Loro, Archbishop of the Catholic Archdiocese of Juba, welcomes the prayer service at the Presidential Palace, but says the country's political leaders have held many prayers before, and what the country needs is lasting peace.
We have been praying a lot in this country, all our churches, all of us. We have been praying for peace, the peace of South Sudan, the peace of our people. We have been praying from here, from this country, and we involved all the world to pray for South Sudan. The last moment with our president, we even reached our religious leaders in the world. You have seen us in the Vatican, and the greatest of our faith, the religious leaders of the world, prayed for us. Not only praying, but they kissed the feet of every South Sudanese.
Archbishop Loro says he's tired of hearing foreigners say South Sudanese know what is happening in their country is bad, but do nothing about it. He says many people continue to suffer and yet the leaders just talk politics and cheat one another.
We have to stop evil in our country and face the truth, face the reality with the help of God. The revitalization program resolutions are very welcome. We, as church, we have accepted that and we have been praying for that. the plans are good or the intentions are good, we need to decide to accept and implement this revitalization program as a whole.
Severia Chan, who took part in the reconciliation prayer, says frequent prayers can help change the situation in South Sudan.
Without prayer, evil cannot go from here. And then our children, which is now on the street, no school for them. This prayer can help. God can hear our prayer. This prayer is very important, even for our president, can help him, can give him strength to rule this country.
In March 2017, the government organized a National Day of Prayer and Fasting for Peace under the theme Repentance and Forgiveness. Last April, President Kiir and Riek Machar traveled to the Vatican at the invitation of Pope Francis to pray for peace in South Sudan and to commit to working together peacefully for the good of the country. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
The Special Representative and Head of the United Nations Mission in South Sudan, or UNMISS, says peace in South Sudan remains precarious, but progress is being made. David Shearer told the UN Security Council on Wednesday that rebel leader Riek Machar's visit to Juba last week was an important development, but he warned three critical areas toward achieving lasting peace remain unresolved.
The recent visit of Dr. Riek Machar to Juba at the invitation of President Salva Kiir was an important development. The face-to-face meetings, which many of us believe are fundamental to moving forward, provided an opportunity to discuss critical unresolved parts of the peace agreement. Importantly, they recommitted to forming the transitional government, a positive step because it maintains the momentum of peace and bolsters confidence among South Sudanese. The challenge remains, of course, is to show tangible results, and three areas in particular require progress. First, the unification of security forces. Of the 35 cantonment sites planned, 23 are now occupied by opposition forces and 10 by the government. But many sites still lack amenities, and protection risks may arise in nearby villages if these shortfalls continue. Secondly, the Independent Boundaries Commission was unable to reach consensus on the number of states and boundaries. Resolution via a referendum, we believe, is implausible given the expense and the time required. Third, the agreement provides for five vice presidents, each leading a cluster of cabinet portfolios. 2 months out from a transitional government, these still need to be determined. And finally, I should mention that the non-signatories to the agreement need to move from violent opposition, for which they've been involved, to constructive participation. Mr. President, 1 year on, peace is beginning to pay dividends for the citizens of South Sudan. The formation of the transitional government provides an opportunity to lift our gaze from immediate challenges and look over the horizon towards elections that are expected at the end of the three-year transition. Criminality remains a serious problem, with random attacks on civilians, commonly by unpaid soldiers and former combatants. Mr. President, the bottom line is simply this. While the situation for many South Sudanese citizens remains bleak, the last year of peace has kick-started a transformative process that is improving people's lives. This could not have happened without the ceasefire or the confidence generated by the peace process. If South Sudan's leaders ever needed inspiration to reconcile and work in the country's best interests, they can find it under the trees and in the tukuls where communities are coming together to build peace. The peace process remains precarious, but progress is being made. Maintaining momentum is the absolute key, and that depends very much on the continuing goodwill of the parties, as well as the collective and unrelenting focus of international friends to support the formation of a transitional government.
That was UNMISS Chief David Shearer briefing the UN Security Council yesterday on the current state of affairs in South Sudan. Returning refugees and internally displaced persons in Ye River County say farmers are producing more food in South Sudan during the year's first harvest season due to relative peace since the signing of last year's peace deal. Some returnees and IDPs say, unlike in the past, they're now able to eat two meals a day. Daniel Friday Martin has that story for VOA from Ye.
Over the past 3 years, local farmers said they did not feel safe tending to their crops because of ongoing violence in parts of Ye River State. Now, Ye River County residents in both rural and semi-urban areas are returning to their farms to produce food for their families. On the outskirts of Ye Town, acres of maize crops are visible and ready for harvest. In High Peace, an area about 2 miles west of Ye Town, women and children are packing maize grains into sacks. Edina Opani, an internal displaced person living in High Peace area, says in the past, she and her husband could not always put food on the table for their 4 children and extended family members. Speaking in her local Kakwa language, Opani says these days she is able to roast fresh maize and cook porridge for her children at least twice a day.
Today my children are no longer crying because of hunger, and I don't want to wait and suffer from the on and off of relief food provided by the United Nations. And that is why we decided to produce our own food.
Opani says after she and her husband spent about 2 months preparing the land for planting season, the two of them planted a variety of vegetables and maize seeds on a half an acre of land. IDP Susan Alone says she has harvested enough food to feed her 2 children and sell vegetables in the market. Speaking in Arabic, Alone says she has earned enough money from her crops to pay her children's school fees.
I have started harvesting and selling my fresh food in the market, 4 pieces at a cost of 100 SSP, and out of the market sales, I am able to buy meat and soap for my family and also pay my children at school. And I also dry some of them to be granted as maize flour.
Earlier this year, NGOs distributed seeds and farm tools to thousands of vulnerable households in a bid to help returnees and IDPs produce their own food. Amber Faustin is program manager for Mugo Development Organization, a local NGO that supports vulnerable farmers. Faustin says his organization provided seeds and tools to returnees and is producing quality seeds that should boost food production in 2020.
We were able to timely bring the seeds and the tools in time. That was in March, and right now the harvest is going on. I think we have tried to engage the local farmers. We are mentoring them up so they can be able to produce seeds that next year can be able to supply a number of households within Ye. And this land, we have divided it to a number of 65 farmers, in which a farmer goes with an acre. The current peace would really prevail such that this population and others in exile can come back and begin assuming their previous farming activities.
Amber is asking parties to the peace deal to lay down their guns and take up programs that promote food security and development. Edmund Taban Gogo is Director General for Horticulture and Ye River State's Ministry of Agriculture and Forestry. Gogo says the food security situation has dramatically improved over the past few months, and he attributes that improvement to the state's commitment to promoting peace and stability in the region.
The harvest this season is really good because there used to be soldiers. Now these soldiers are withdrawn from those areas. People have no access to land. So far there, people have at least 1.5 pedans or 2 pedans. They've increased the acreage. So we still continue to encourage them to prepare land now for the second season, which will begin in August and then ends in October. The country is going to go in peace totally.
IDP Opani says she hopes signatories to the River Talese Peace Agreement form a unity government by the November deadline so that IDPs and refugees can return home and produce food.
We want peace and stable security to allow us to return to our previous villages so that we can start really farming in the village. We need to produce food by ourselves because we don't want to depend on the government and NGOs to provide us with food assistance.
Ye River State, which runs into the equatorial tropical forest, is known for having fertile soil and a favorable climate suitable for agriculture. It is often referred to as the food basket of South Sudan. For VOA News, I'm Daniel Friday Martin, reporting from Yatown.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. World leaders gather in New York to talk about how to eradicate global poverty. Find out more when we return.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
name one skill you think every young person should have and why.
Every young person should know how to communicate. I lecture sometimes, and I tell my students, papers don't talk. You will talk. If you can't say simple things like, excuse me, thank you, I mean, you'll not get that job.
I would wish if the young people are given a skill or business, especially the entrepreneurship, so that they should be the decision makers and be the owners of the business by themselves.
I think every youth is supposed to have the interactive skill. If you know how to handle different people in different ways, it will help you to live with them cordially.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. More than 150 world leaders are preparing to attend the UN Sustainable Development Summit in New York beginning September 25th, with the aim of agreeing on a new agenda to tackle global poverty. But a new report warns that African children are being left further and further behind and will make up more than half of the world's poor by the year 2030. As Henry Ridgewell reports from London, the report's authors are scathing of both African governments and the international community for failing to adequately tackle the problem.
The United Nations has 17 sustainable development goals. Number one on the list is eradicating extreme poverty by 2030. The world will fall well short of that target, according to the latest report from Save the Children and the Overseas Development Institute. It delivers a devastating verdict on global efforts to eradicate extreme poverty among children in Africa. Kevin Watkins is chief executive of Save the Children UK.
On our projection, children in Africa will account for around 55% of all extreme poverty in the world by 2030.
The report authors say Africa's children are being left further and further behind and predict that 87 million African children will be born into poverty each year in the 2020s.
On average, women are still having 4 to 5 children. And it's the part of the world where poverty is coming down most slowly, partly because of slow growth, but also because of very high levels of inequality.
An estimated 40% of Africans still live on less than $1.90 a day. Again, Kevin Watkins.
A child born into poverty faces greater risks of illiteracy, greater risks of mortality before the age of 5. They're between 2 and 3 times more likely to die before their 5th birthday. They're far less likely to escape poverty themselves, which means that they will become the transmission mechanism for poverty to another generation.
The report criticizes African governments for failing to develop coherent policies and also warns that the IMF, the World Bank and other donors are failing in their response. More than 150 world leaders are due to attend the United Nations Sustainable Development Summit later this month in New York and will aim to agree on an agenda for the next 15 years. Dramatic changes in approach are urgently needed, says Watkins.
Transferring more monetary resources to children who are living in poverty has to be part of the solution. But we know also that money is not enough. It's critically important that these children get access to the basic nutritional services, the basic health interventions, and the school systems that they need to escape poverty.
The report warns that if poverty reduction targets are not met, the world will also fall well short on other sustainable development goals in education, health and gender equality. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
And there's another troubling report out today on the health of African women and children. New UN data shows sub-Saharan Africa lags far behind all other regions in the world in reducing child and maternal mortality. Estimates by the World Health Organization and the UN Children's Fund reveal that conflict, fragile health systems, and poverty are some of the factors accounting for millions of preventable child and maternal deaths. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the launch of the report in Geneva.
The UN agency says since 2000, child deaths have dropped by nearly one half, and maternal deaths are down by more than one third, mostly due to better access to affordable, quality health services. The new estimates, however, show that 6.2 million children under the age of 15 died last year, and nearly 300,000 women died of complications related to pregnancy and childbirth in 2017. The agency's report, a pregnant woman or newborn dies every 11 seconds somewhere in the world, mostly of preventable causes. Peter Salama is WHO's executive director of universal health coverage. He says women and children in sub-Saharan Africa are at higher risk of death than in all other regions.
In 2017, for the first time, half of all child deaths occurred in sub-Saharan Africa. Because of increasing fertility rates, we project that number to reach more than 60% of all global child deaths. For maternal deaths today, two-thirds occur in sub-Saharan Africa.
Salama says the lifetime risk of a woman dying of pregnancy-related causes is around 1 in 37 in Africa, compared to 1 in 7,800 in Australia, his home country. He says the risk of delivering a baby in countries with a stable government is far less than in countries affected by conflict. He says countries with modest means can make progress in reducing child and maternal mortality. He cites Belarus, Bangladesh, Cambodia, Malawi, and Zambia.
It's clear one reason is they've made a heavy investment in sexual, reproductive, maternal, newborn, and child health. They're choosing the right programs and they're investing accordingly in them. But that's not the whole story. They're investing in primary health care and in universal health coverage. In short, they're investing in more comprehensive and integrated systems.
The UN Sustainable Development Goals aim to reduce maternal mortality to less than 70 per 100,000 live births and under 5 child mortality to at least 25 per 1,000 live births by 2030. WHO and UNICEF say the world must act now and invest the money needed to reduce these deaths. They warn otherwise 62 million children under the age of 5 will die between now and 2030, and more than a million maternal lives will be lost. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The conflict in South Sudan has affected South Sudanese who resettled in North America. Some parents, who are busy with work and paying their bills, say the political polarization of the community has affected their children. Lucky Kundu, a South Sudanese community leader in Kitchener, Canada, says some children drop out of school because they are not getting enough support from their community, who are divided along ethnic lines.
The factories are waiting for them, because they have enough for energy. And this is what actually the system here like them to be like that, especially for us, the immigrants. At the end of the day, they will go because they find life very hard and difficult. They will go and join the factories or the companies and work in the factories. When you look at Southern Sudanese community in general here, you cannot really feel happy as you came with an expectations of children coming here, get educated to the high level of education. Those dreams are not there. you see, for us here. Our dream and target was to bring these children here and, you know, giving them a chance of education so that they can be our leaders of tomorrow, so that they can go back home whenever the situation comes conducive. But very unfortunate.
Is there going to be any change? Is there going to be a generation that will change this?
Time is not yet late. Need us as community leaders, plus the youth, come together and discuss this issue, coming out with a strategy that can change their mentality and their thinking. What is good for their future? As a drop-off from grade 12, is it helping him in the future? To me, I don't think it is a good idea, because it won't help them in the future. Working in the factory for 10 to 15 years, you are getting old already. Yeah? And imagine you are working manual job with your hands. It's not an easy thing. But the best tool, the best weapon for them is to continue, change their mentality and continue with the education so that they can change their lives.
Yeah, but what about the issue of people divided? Here it's a divided community. You are not one. People from Upper Nile on their own, the people from Bahr al-Ghazal, and the people from Equatoria on their own. How is that impacting on the effort to bring people together and preach what you want them to be?
You know, when we came here, the community as a Southern Sudanese community, it was a very strong community. We used to have, even when we came here first, they welcome us with a spirit of Sudanese and Southern Sudanese, you know, that kind of a spirit. But 2013, let me just go right to the point. 2013, when, I don't know whether we call it a civil war or just people intend to call it a civil war, when it erupted in South Sudan, it affected us here right away.
How did it affect you?
Because now becomes an issue of Dinka versus Nuer and Nuer versus Dinka, and you know, news coming in and out that Equatorians becomes a community apart from the other tribes. This is split the whole thing, you see, and even it has reached to the level of now Chuluk different, Nuer different, Fayulu different. You know, it is split us into smaller groups, which was not there at all.
That is Lucky Kundu, a South Sudanese elder in Kitchener, Canada, speaking with my colleague John Tanza. Tomorrow, in part 3 of our series on South Sudanese living in Canada, Kundu talks about the rate of school dropouts among South Sudanese in Canada. That's our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with the song Joro Mi by Simi.
Joro Mi, I want you to love me. Joro Mi, baby.
Joro Mi, Joro.
Kilode, Kilode. Why you know they call me? Kilode, baby.
Kilode, Joro.
I didn't give you signal.
Joro Mi.
Why you know they see me?
Joro Mi.
I give you green light to tire.
Joro Mi, Joro.
I'm a killer, Bobo.
Joro Mi.
I go shoot my shot to your Joro. So Joro, baby, take my number. Talk to your friend, oh, Joro Mi, baby, oh,
Joro Mi, Joro.
We've been listening to See Me with the song Joro Mi. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Thanks for being here. We hope you can join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America.
I give you green light, fire.